Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Jack Loeffler. He is an oral historian, and he's the author of the book Adventures with Ed, A Portrait of Abby, about Ed Abbey. Welcome, Jack Loeffler.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
So your life, you've written so many books, you are active in so many areas in music and radio production, environmentalism. Your best friend was the great writer and environmentalist Ed Abbey.
Yeah, I was very honored to have him for a buddy.
And you wrote a book about him, which was both a biography and a memoir of your time together.
Absolutely. It started out as it was supposed to have been a biography. But it turns out you can't really write a biography about your best friend because there are just too many personal things that get in the way of that. And so in order to really try to give a sense of who Ed really was, I wrote this memoir that included not only a lot of real digging into his own writing and his journals and everything he'd ever written about himself, but also our friendship, which extended for a long, long time and was basically based on being campfire partners for many years. And we figured, as he was laying there dying one day, we figured we'd hike the equivalent across the United States together, talking.
Wow. Now, you, even before you met him, you had been made aware of him. You had a job basically doing fire lookout somewhere here in, was it in New Mexico?
Yes, it was. I was a fire lookout up on top of Caracas Mesa in the Jicarilla Ranger District of the Carson National Forest. And our lookout, the lookout up there was about, 7 miles down the back end of the Mesa to get to the San Juan River, right across from Colorado.
And so one day somebody said, you know, you really should meet this guy, Ed Abbey, and he's a writer. And so you thought about that. And then one day you saw one of his books, and it went on from there.
Actually, Ed and I had met before then, it turns out. there used to be a bar called Claude's Bar up on Canyon Road. It was a great bar. It was
here one in Santa Fe.
Yes, here in Santa Fe. And in 1962, I hired on as the waiter bouncer. And Ed was, I like to think of him as the bouncee. I never bounced him, but at least not in the bar. But we had a lot of fun. And that was when we first met, but we first really got into it at that time, back in around 1969 or so.
So you read one of his books and you felt a very deep connection in the way both of you related to the land that you loved very much, which was the Southwest.
Absolutely. I will read to you. I'd like to read to you. This was in Desert Solitaire.
Was that the first book of his that you read?
Yes, it was. That came out in 1968. As a matter of fact, last year was the 40th anniversary of the publication of Desert Solitaire. In that book, in his sort of introductory remarks, and I'll quote, he had gone to Arches. He was the backcountry ranger there, back when it was still backcountry. and totally desolate solitude up there. It was wonderful then. And he said in his introduction to Desert Solitaire, quote, "I am here not only to evade for a while the clamor and filth and confusion of the cultural apparatus, but also to confront immediately and directly, if it's possible, the bare bones of existence, the elemental and fundamental, the bedrock which sustains us. I dream of a hard and brutal mysticism in which the naked self merges with the non-human world and yet survives still intact, individual, separate." End of quote.
And you read that and said, "I understand this man."
I said, "Ah, Abby, you bastard, you know, don't you?"
Same thing. And so you met, it was at a campfire with lots of beer. Beer is a theme in this book. And got to be friends over a long time. And this, what were the words? Brutal mysticism?
Yes, he said that. He took that out of later editions of Desert Solitaire, but and I'm not sure why, because I think he was afraid that he might be regarded as a mystic, which he was in his own way, but he didn't want to be thought of in, within the context of today's perception of mysticism.
So his contribution to the environmental movement was huge. And I want to talk about that because it's a long and complex story. He was very much, in a way, an anarchist, an environmentalist, and combined those two things.
To me, that was fundamentally his great contribution to Western culture. He wanted to be thought of basically as a writer, an artist with great literary talent, which he was. But his purview extended beyond that, and basically he did meld anarchism with environmentalism to found an entirely new school of practice, a community of practice is a good phrase there, where environmentalists really began to take it seriously, and defending wilderness and defending habitat became absolutely vital, and defending it in a really good way, or powerful way, let's put it that way.
What did he, and what do you mean by anarchism? That is a word that basically means lack of government, but it means a lot more than that and has deep roots.
I would like to read to you, my favorite anarchist philosopher is Peter Kropotkin. Kropotkin was a turn of the 20th century Russian philosopher who was also trained as a geographer and had spent a great deal of time out within the flow of nature, both mapping mountains in Siberia and also armed with Darwin. I think Darwin's first book came out the year Kropotkin was born, at least close there. But in an essay that he had written, it was a revolutionary pamphlet that he had written to scientists. Peter Kropotkin made his definition of the anarchist society, and I'd like to read that because it remains to me the very best definition. And this is a quote. "The anarchists conceive a society in which all its members are regulated not by laws, not by authorities, whether self-imposed or elected, but by mutual agreements between the members of that society and by a sum of social customs and habits, not petrified by law, routine, or superstition, but concordance with the ever-growing requirements of a free life, stimulated by the progress of science, invention, and the steady growth of higher ideals. No ruling authorities, then, no government of man by man, no crystallization and immobility, but a continual evolution, such as we see in nature." End of quote. And that really says it. Now, a lot of people construe anarchism to be synonymous with bomb throwing, and indeed there have been a few assassinations by anarchists, but the true anarchist philosophers, the great ones, saw that, as Kropotkin did, that revolution was basically a hastening of the process of evolution within a cultural sense.
It's also very idealistic, which you and Edward Abbey acknowledged.
It's so idealistic that it's unattainable, but it's an ideal to strive for. We're not the only anarchists about. Another great friend of mine, poet and writer Gary Snyder, is also very much an anarchist thinker. And I used to think of Gary as more in the Kropotkinian vein and Abbey more in the Bakunin vein. Bakunin
right.
was the bomb thrower. He was the battler at the barricades. They even kind of looked alike. And when he died, Peter Kropotkin sort of inherited the mantle of being, if you can think of it this way, the leader of the, it's sort of a, it doesn't really work to say the leader of the anarchist movement because theoretically anarchists don't have leaders
right.
or followers. But he developed the theory. As a matter of fact, Kropotkin wrote the best essay on anarchist thought, which appears in the 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica. It's the 11th edition, the 1911 edition, the 11th edition of the Britannica. And the article on anarchist thought or anarchism is written by Kropotkin, and it prevails as by far the best definition.
And it is, among other things, a reaction to a lot of problems in society, whether it be turn of the 20th century or today or anywhere in between, of basically excessive authoritarianism, bureaucracy, and crazy laws and unnecessary laws.
Absolutely. Now, what Ed did, or was he contributed to very greatly, was expanding the purview of anarchist thought to include the rest of the biotic community, not just the human community, which is sort of where Kropotkin left off.
Right.
And Ed took it the next step. Another philosopher, who, again, Gary Snyder and others, have advanced the notion of bioregional thought, which is very much in a similar vein. But Ed took it to today's world because he recognized that there comes a time when you really have to say no to encroachment.
Now, he grew up in Pennsylvania, born and raised there in Appalachia, and came out to the West when he was, in his late teens, and fell in love with the Southwest.
He got drafted, as did many people. It was right at the end of World War II, and he got out of the Army. He was born in 1927, January 29th, 1927. He hitchhiked around the United States before he went in the Army. And at one point, he'd hopped a freight in Needles, California, and hopped off in Albuquerque and just sort of began to soak up the taste of New Mexico and realized that this was more homeland to him than home Pennsylvania, the name of the town where he grew up.
We're talking with Jack Loeffler, oral historian and author of the book Adventures with Ed, A Portrait of Abby. What happened next? How did his life take shape? I mean, somebody whose story that is, I mean, Ed Abbey, probably didn't say at the age of 17, I want to be a writer, anarchist, environmentalist, did he? Where was he coming from at that early age?
Looking at his journals, it's interesting. Somebody once asked me if there's such a thing as a born anarchist, and I think there is. I think Ed certainly was. And, well, I must say also, interject, that his dad, Paul Revere Abbey, was very much a socialist, a friend of, or at least an acquaintance of Eugene Debs, and a strong quoter of Walt Whitman. And so Ed grew up with those wondrous words of wisdom. But Ed realized a proclivity for writing early on. He also realized a real proclivity for music. He had a very advanced ear for music. As a matter of fact, he dedicated what he regards as his fat masterpiece, The Fool's Progress. He dedicated that novel to Charles Ives.
Really?
Yeah. Ives, by the way, was an anarchist insurance agent in Hartford, if you can imagine that.
There's a little contradiction in there somewhere.
But Ed, actually, I was just realizing, Ed really was about as consistent a person throughout his life as anybody I've ever encountered. I have a letter he wrote to his mom when he was in the Army. And the handwriting in that letter is the same as the handwriting on the last piece of written stuff. I got a lot of letters from Ed over the years.
Really?
And the handwriting changed. Not at all. It was amazing to me.
And that's a reflection of his character really staying consistent as well.
Yeah. He was as consistent a person as I've ever met. He was as complex a person as I've ever met. And sometimes his writing, it does in some cases, but in a lot of ways, his notion with regard to writing was to be as clear as the desert air. Very few frills, but boy, his mind was as complex as any mind I've ever encountered.
It's so interesting that you say in your book that he had a huge vocabulary, but didn't use it in his writing because he wanted the writing to be of and for the people.
Absolutely. He wanted it simple and clear. I found one of the things in my book I quoted from his journals was where he talked about other writers, people that he really liked and those he didn't like. Would you like me to read that? Now, this is a quote. It's about three paragraphs long, but it really gives a good idea of the writers that Ed really liked and the ones that he didn't like. And so, quote, B. Traven, Dreiser, James Jones et al., their prose is so bad, so crude, so stupid, that it's painful to read. And yet these lads often wrote better books than such master stylists as Henry James, Joyce, Nabokov, Proust. Why? Perhaps there's something in great verbal felicity that misleads the writer, that betrays him into technique for the sake of technique, while the simple-minded prose writers, free of such allurements, are able to keep their attention fixed on the subject of their interest, the real life of actual human beings. Thus, their work, while repellent in style and detail, achieves great cumulative power through its steadfast devotion to fact, which equals and in the long run is equivalent to the supreme poetry of truth. The greatest writers are those capable of both powers, that is, Tolstoy, Conrad, Chekhov, Hemingway, Cervantes, Steinbeck, and so on. Whom, then, shall we praise? Why, Cervantes, Rabelais, Villon, Melville, Twain, Dreiser, Traven, Hemingway, Wolfe, Conrad, Tolstoy, Chekhov, Camus, Flaubert, Mann, and Heine, and Brecht, Whitman, and Thoreau, Beckett, and O'Casey, and Shaw, and Dylan Thomas, Knute Hampson, Jack London, John Steinbeck, Robinson Jeffers, 100 or so others, I suppose. For example, Sartre, Russell, that's Bertrand Russell, actually. Andreev, Gorky? No, I think not. Shakespeare was a good poet, but had the soul of a sycophant, the heart of a toady. That servile streak that poisons English literature begins with him. Neglected writers: Wendell Berry, William Eastlake, Alan Harrington, Algren, Traven, Van Tilburg Clark, Wolfe, the real one, the author, Steinbeck, Mumford. Stuffed mediocrities: Bellows, Updike, Mailer, Gardner, sore heads and sour grape juice. I really envy Pinchon, Coover, McWane. Am tired of being the famous unknown underground author. McPhee can't get through his books, exasperated by his constant temporizing. Alaska book, though highly praised by the New York School of Literary Fish, the most disappointing of all. End of quote.
Wow.
That says it. That's,
well, and there's a both a humility and a supreme arrogance in that, which I think characterizes this person.
Yeah, one of the things that he had to say about Shakespeare, which I really enjoyed enormously, was that there are no real heroes in Shakespeare. As close as he comes to, in Ed's opinion, to real heroes would be Caliban, the bad guys, basically. You know, Macbeth. You know, they're sort of negative heroes, but
that's food for thought.
It really is.
What about Cordelia?
No, one would have to really look at it within
the context.
Yeah, but what he was saying was that Shakespeare had that facility with words, but in Ed's opinion, didn't really have the philosophical chops to really be as highly regarded as he is. Interesting thought.
Hmm.
Huh?
In any case, so Edward Abbey. So he spent time out in the backcountry by himself in nature. Didn't he also have a job as a fire lookout the way you did?
Yeah, there's sort of a fraternity of fire lookouts. And
what is that job anyway?
That's where you sit up on top of a high place, usually in a tower, with a radio and a pair of binoculars and a map. And you keep looking out over the countryside. And if you spot a smoke, you shoot an azimuth and give the location of the smoke and then call it in on the radio. My fire lookout didn't have a tower. It was just up on top of this rock. And that's where I lived for 100 days a year, was up on top of this rock.
And you sat on the rock, read books,
yep,
looked for fire,
yep,
were utterly alone and utterly happy.
Well, I did have my first wife, I must say. She and I were up there together, and we had a ball up there because it was peaceful. We'd go for whole days without saying a word to each other because we were becoming ever more immersed, and I was becoming ever more immersed in that incredible natural place. I remember one day, this is back in the days when I still played the trumpet, but I remember one day pulling out my trumpet and starting to play, just sitting up there on the rock, and then a coyote and a turkey both started making their calls at the same time, and we did this little natural sonata out there in the Hickory country. It was really fun. It's a great place to be. As a matter of fact, it was there that I realized just how important it is to recognize our relationship to the flow of nature. That's when it really began to dawn on me back in the 1960s.
That very important insight that many of us living in cities or even just in towns don't have so much, which is that we are just one of many animals, one of many creatures, one of many species.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that Ed recognized. He pointed out that it wasn't even just other creatures that you also have to have that same intensity of love for the water and the rocks and the air, because it's all part of a whole.
Right.
In other words, the planet itself is a living organism. One of the things that interests me, we talked about this, Ed and I, at length, and then I read it in a book by Edward O. Wilson much later after Ed had died, but that indeed the human consciousness might indeed be the mind of the planet.
Very interesting idea.
I like that thought.
Give a little moment of silence for that to sink in. We're talking to Jack Loeffler, author of the book Adventures with Ed, A Portrait of Abby. There's a place in the very beginning of the book where you quote Edward Abbey talking about being in nature and getting to a place beyond anthropomorphism.
Yeah, that's actually, well, that was kind of part of that introduction from Desert Solitaire, because he didn't want to be, in other words, he was trying to escape the anthropomorphic. And that's a hard thing to do, because we have now, however many generations our species has been into anthropomorphizing everything we see, hundreds of generations, thousands maybe. And what he was trying to do was get rid of those filters and see himself as a biological entity among other biological entities within the context of the flow of nature, which is a concept that others, I know Gary Snyder knows that deeply. He's also an ex-fire lookout. I think probably every fire lookout knows that, because you just are out there. That's just the way it is.
And the world really doesn't have human form. We are just one part of it.
Absolutely. One of the things that really comes to mind, one of Ed's favorite writers, actually, was Lao Tzu. And somewhere in this book, I quote Ed, where he'd said, probably the best little book of all time, referring to the Tao Te Ching.
Right.
Which I think is really interesting. Now, his philosophy professor at the University of New Mexico happened to be the author of one of the interpretations of the Tao Te Ching. Archie Baim was this man's name. And I actually interviewed Archie Baim after Ed died, just to see. Archie was still alive. I should say this, is that back in 1963, I picked up this particular edition of the Tao Te Ching. I'd probably read 8 or 9 of them by then. I've read as many of them as I could find. And this was the one that really struck me powerfully, and it turned out it was Archie Baim's version, and it was Archie who was Ed's professor, and undoubtedly it was Archie Baim who introduced Ed to the writing of Lao Tzu, who thought he was probably the best philosopher of all time.
And it's very interesting, because Edward Abbey also really considered himself an atheist and had a contempt for a lot of organized religion. And I think there's one point where he calls himself something like an atheist, but really an earthiest.
Yeah, that's true. And I remember him saying that on several occasions. He didn't really think of himself as an atheist, because at one point, well, many of our discussions, we camped a lot, as I mentioned earlier, and many of our discussions really revolved around what really is that deeper consciousness, that stuff that seems to run considerably deeper than intellect. And we both wondered at that big time, at the so-called mystical experience. Now, he told me that he'd experienced that incredible intuition of oneness with the planet one time while being in Death Valley, in such a profound way that it completely rearranged him. He had taken no substance. He was just out there and had been camped, and it hit him, that powerful understanding, which is great. And campers, people who get out in it for a long enough period of time, can touch into that pretty deeply. I know that both Ed and I contended that if you're out in it for a good 2 weeks, you begin to taste it. But if you stay there longer, you really begin to get into it. To really get into it, you just have to be out there for months.
When that experience is combined with what you might call a more philosophical anarchism, the conclusions are really a kind of earth first type of set of ideas that the earth itself has rights as much as human beings have rights.
Actually, there's a school of thought that the earth has a heck of a lot more rights than humans do. And I think that was probably fundamental to the original concept of earth first back in the good old days. One of the fundamental ideas, the basic tenet of earth first, is that one causes no harm to any fellow human. And actually, that comes right out of a point of view where terrorism has to be clearly defined. And terrorism is not practicing ecotage or sabotage against the implements of what the real terrorism is, which is taking out vast quantities of life, whether it's chaining down trees or anything like that.
I think that's a very important point that Edward Abbey makes, that the real terrorism is terrorism against life itself.
Absolutely.
Not just human life.
And one of the things that he vociferated time and again is that the United States had committed great acts of terrorism against the people of Vietnam during that debacle. And so the whole point of Earth First was to protect habitat from human encroachment, but never, ever, ever cause harm to any fellow human.
And that really gets into a piece of anarchist philosophy, which is there may not be laws in your ideal world and there may not be government, but there are ethical principles.
In the anarchist, in the highest sense of anarchist thought, it's a very ethically oriented point of view, and it requires extraordinary self-discipline to become or to be a practicing anarchist from within that particular context. But in a sense, it's the highest ideal. And one of the things that Ed liked to mention occasionally was that he regarded Lao Tzu, author ostensibly of the Tao Te Ching, as the first really evolved anarchist thinker. However, Joseph Proudhon was the first person to ever call himself an anarchist back in the mid-19th century. I did a book many years ago now, 20, 25 years ago, called Headed Upstream, Interviews with Iconoclasts. And one of the iconoclasts that I interviewed is my very good friend Dave Foreman, who was one of the founders of Earth First. And he talked about that original philosophy of the founding of Earth First. This was back in the very early days of it. Dave and I had known each other since we were both environmental activists starting in 1971, if you can believe that, really into it on a very radically, supposedly, environmentally oriented scale. And then Earth First took it the next step. But the upshot was is that people who get out in it a lot realize just how sacred the landscape really is. And which brings up something that I'm really working on in my current book. Native Americans, people who are indigenous to habitat, or people who really are fortunate to have spent a lot of time out in it without having all of the luxurious appliances around us all the time, really begin to sense more and more and more the sacred quality of landscape. Whereas our culture as a whole, so totally fundamentally oriented to a materialistic point of view, which comes with the Industrial Revolution but has philosophical underpinnings that extend way back, our culture is basically oriented to turning habitat into money, which is about 180 degrees from a proper attitude with regard to how to see ourselves relative to where we live.
I think that really sums it up. And this absolute horror and outrage and pain when beholding the destruction of the land that he loved and that you loved so well here in the Southwest and all over the United States, that was something that really drove Edward Abbey's work.
It sure did. If there were a monument to all that was negative, it's the Glen Canyon Dam. Ed hated that dam He detested that dam, and he imagined somebody taking out that dam. As a matter of fact, I've got to mention that at one point he strongly suggested that maybe he and I sink a houseboat full of TNT behind the dam with a timer on it and then be upstream up in the Lake Powell so that when the dam blew, we could have a very swift trip down through the Grand Canyon. Listening to the 9 symphonies of Beethoven.
A true anarchist. That's more the bomb-wielding type.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad we didn't, though. I lobbied vigorously against it because there are people down in the bottom of that canyon. The Supai Indians, the Havasus, all of those people would meet with a dreadful fate.
Right.
Should that have occurred. And Ed understood that. And, of course, we never did that.
Now, Earth First, and you can tell us maybe a little bit more about them, but they were very much influenced by the writings of Edward Abbey.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question that Ed Abbey was sort of the spiritual guide for all of them. His novel, The Monkey Wrench Gang, which came out in 1975, really set the tone for Earth First. And the four characters, the four protagonists of that novel, really reflect a team devoted to protecting habitat against the encroachment of developers at all. And that novel, by the way, he gave me the original manuscript, I got it in there, of that novel, because he and I did a lot of research together for that novel, crawling around out there on Black Mesa. But that brings up a point that I'd like to look at for a sec. The Monkey Wrench Gang, in large measure, addressed the presence of the Glen Canyon Dam and also the strip mine up on Black Mesa in northern Arizona. The purpose of that coal mining operation was to provide coal in large measure for the Navajo Generating Station, which is situated on the banks of Lake Powell, which then fires up generators and pumps electricity through what my wife calls the electric kachinas down through the power lines all the way down to the banks of Lake Havasu, where it pumps water out of that lake and into the central valleys of Arizona. Basically, the Central Arizona Project is responsible for what to me is the great environmental debacle of all time, which is the whole rape of Black Mesa and all that stuff. And Ed saw that, and it was really curious to me in retrospect, and I didn't even realize this till after Ed was dead and I was rereading The Monkey Wrench Gang, because the first time I read it, it was the original manuscript. He never mentioned the Central Arizona Project in that novel, and yet it truly was the villain in this whole great big thing, which goes back in time. And, you know, there's a huge, it's one of the most complex issues, but the American Southwest is a complex issue from the point of view of, well, many points of view. But the Colorado River is the most adjudicated river system in the United States. It is so complicated that the mayordomo of that river, the lower basin of that river, is the Secretary of the Interior. That's pretty far out.
Right. And it's a river that is so tapped into that its life force has just been dissipated.
One of the things our mutual buddy Bill DeBuise points out is that there's not a drop of that water that has been allocated to the river itself.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's that same idea of resources flowing out but not being replenished. Nothing goes back in. And turning habitat, turning nature into money, but not giving anything back to nature.
Absolutely. And we have reached a point in time as we speak right now, as we're facing the extraordinary complexity of global warming and climate change, plus myriad other factors, where we have to make a very hasty step into an extraordinarily larger point of view culturally that's infinitely more realistic. Otherwise, we're out of here.
And that's very hard for people to do because we like our comforts, and for good reason.
Oh, absolutely. I am surrounded by comforts. I can't believe the luxury in which I live.
Yeah. The refrigerator,
yep,
which we turned off so that it wouldn't make noise during this conversation. We're talking with Jack Loeffler, oral historian and author of the book Adventures with Ed, A Portrait of Abbey. Now, Edward Abbey was a person of great passion and great humor. And one of the wonderful things about your book, Adventures with Ed, A Portrait of Abbey, is that you recreate a lot of conversations that the two of you had, and a lot of the just falling over laughing humor that you shared with each other, and also his passion for women, his five wives, and Lord knows how many other women in his life, and his love of his children. A very, as passionate as he was, cerebral.
He sure was. At one point, he wondered if he were suffering from a state of satyrmania. But finally he concluded that he, being as honest as he could possibly be, was simply responding to the masculine part of a biological imperative, which is the way it works with men. And so he finally came to peace with that as best he possibly could and lived his life.
And also had very much of a love. I mean, you write about the things that he said about his last wife, whom he adored, whom he missed when he wasn't with her, and spoke very humbly about how human beings are at their best when they're giving to other people.
Absolutely. Well, that kind of goes back to the Kropotkinian sense of anarchist society, where people achieve everything by consensus within the context of friendship. He had the highest regard for friendship, and I'm wondering if I can just find something here, a quote. Yeah, this is from a paper I wrote many years ago for Western American Literature about Ed. And I was citing what he had written in his journal about friendship. At that point, he had a Fulbright scholarship to Edinburgh, Scotland, as he called it, in 1951. And I should mention that he, at that point, fell madly in love with a lady cellist whom he never met and was wildly...
Whom he never met?
No, but he watched her playing the cello, and he was quite jealous of the cello. That was it. At any rate, this is about friendship. Quote, God help me, I will never sacrifice a friend to an ideal. I will never betray a friend for the sake of any cause. I will never reject a friend in order to stand by an institution. Great nations may fall in dusty ruin before I will sell a friend to save them. I pray to the God within me to give me the power to live by this design. That was in his journal, and that later translated into the leitmotif for his book, The Brave Cowboy, which was later turned into the film Lone Leader the Brave, which to me is one of the great films. That was a Kirk Douglas film.
Written by Dalton Trumbo.
Yes, absolutely. And Ed actually at one point, I think I mentioned in the book, that in a way he appreciated Dalton Trumbo's film script even more than the novel.
But than his own novel.
That novel remains, to me, one of his very best. I love that book.
You were with him up until just about the moment that he died. You really went through life with him. Your families knew each other. The two of you had that special kind of friendship that sometimes two men or two women have when you share a soul. You know, it's like soulmates, really. And then he died, and then you did something which a biographer has to do, which you would never do when your friend was alive, which is you read his papers, you read his diaries. How long after his death did you start that process? Did you know that you were going to write a biography or a memoir about him?
No. Ed had mentioned to me two or three times, or asked me two or three times, to be his chronicler. And I was, you know, at the time, I thought, wow, are you kidding? No way, Jose. But then Crown Publishing asked me to write this book. And so I spent a lot of time working on this book. They gave me a handsome advance to write this book. And then they, for some reason, stopped publishing anything at all that came out of an environmentalist's pen. All really? Environmental writers, Dave Foreman, all, a whole bunch of us just got excluded from that whole milieu. As Ed said, we were all born on the wrong side of the Hudson. But
what does that? I don't understand. What does that mean?
Well, in other words, the people that he disliked, people like John Updike and other writers.
Oh, they just like New Englanders, but not people from the West?
Well, they were basically the sycophants who inhabited the publishing houses of Manhattan, whereas the real writers out West were the ones, as far as he was concerned, who were the best.
So you were asked to write this book, but then they changed their minds and decided not to publish it.
Yeah, but I was one of 200 writers. They just turned them down because they had paid me well, both the initial advance and the final, the rest of it, for having written the book, and it was accepted. And then they went through their own inner turmoil, I have to say. I think that they became part of a larger organization that was purchased by a German, probably part of, well, at any rate.
Right, during that whole consolidation.
Yeah, and so sat on the book for 10 years and then thought, gee whiz. And so I got the rights back from it, for it, and took it down to UNM, which is where Ed went to college. At
right.
the University of New Mexico for
right.
both bachelor's and master's degrees, and they really snapped it right up.
And so you published it 7 years ago. What was it like to go through his diaries and to read his papers? I mean, you know somebody so well, and then you know another part of them.
Well, at first, that was a really tough call. It was a really tough call because it was tough because Ed, having been my compañero, my best friend. And when he died, it just sort of leaves you in this total dead spot. You know, it's as close to despair as I've ever gotten. And the idea of writing a book about Ed at that moment in time just seemed like, oh, how can I possibly do it? And then it turns out in retrospect, it's the best thing I ever did because I really worked through a bunch of stuff. But the University of Arizona was gracious in giving me a copy of all of Ed's journals. And then I actually went back and picked up other things back in home Pennsylvania that his dad gave me, papers of Ed's and everything, and a bunch of stuff.
So his father outlived him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his father and I became friends, Paul Revere Abbey. I had known him. I knew his mom. I knew one brother, Hoots, and his sister, Nancy. And there were a couple of other brothers whom I never had met, but... Boy, going back to the little house in home Pennsylvania, just a very rural town in Appalachia, and going to where he grew up, it was really pretty poignant. You got to understand that. And I had his daughter Susie with me at the time. Susie and I and Nancy, his sister, went and visited his dad. By that time, his mom had died. That was a pretty hefty period. My dad died October 29th, 1988. Ed's mom died in November of 1988. My wife's father died in December of 1988. And then Ed died in March of 1989.
Good heavens.
And it was really incredible. I mean, you start to get pretty out there, you know, and see what death really is, you know. And there are great holes left in your own consciousness when people who are close to you go. And so... I got all of these journals, you know, he wrote, he was trying to catch up with Henry David Thoreau, but he never made it as far as numbers of journals. But he outlived Thoreau by 14 or so years, come to think of it. And brought him home, I've got him here, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And I started going through all of this stuff, all of the letters he'd sent me that I hadn't thrown away. And then I read all 21 of his books and really... dug into it, and it took me about 2 years to finish writing this book. And at the end of it, I felt like it's as good as I could do.
A lot of the book is dialogue between the two of you or with other people as well, basically recreated. That's a, I guess they call that creative nonfiction.
Well, it's funny. T. Corgison Boyle reviewed this book for the New York Times. And he was saying, what sort of a memory does Loeffler have anyway?
I was wondering the same thing.
But then I also keep journals. And I collected something like 8 or 9 journals of just conversations that Ed and I'd had.
So you actually wrote down the conversations after you had them, kind of as dialogue?
Well, or as as notes as to what they were. But then I also recorded Ed, too, on three different occasions and got down on tape, which is it's wonderful. I actually, on March 14th of this year, I produced a one-hour radio special of Edward Abbey. It's sort of an Ed Abbey self-portrait, which I will give you a copy of because maybe KSFR would like to run it at some point. But it's Ed talking about himself. And I knew the way we were with each other when we talked. And this is as honest a presentation as it's possible to make. And these conversations were all totally real.
It is funny, too, as a portrait of a friendship, beer plays a very large role. And I, you know, sometimes I thought, I mean, with great respect, but it's like, these guys are like teenage boys.
Yep. We were, actually. And it's funny because we were both in middle age for much of this book, but, or much of, well, Ed died at the age of 62 years and 45 days. He wasn't all that old when he died.
Yeah.
I've actually outlasted him. This August, it'll be 10 years, relatively speaking.
Right.
He was 9.5 years older than I. And, but one of the neat things is if you don't have a job and you're just who you are, you don't have to grow up.
Is that good?
I think it's great. I still haven't, you know, I'll be 73 in July and it's still as good now as it ever was.
As much as Edward Abbey loved the earth and loved the species on the earth and had that sense of oneness and connection, for example, he hated ants.
He sure did. Anytime we were out camping and he had to take a leak, he'd pee on an ant hole. Just about two times that I know of, ants crawled in his ears when he was camped, sleeping out on the ground. And I remember one time, the only time he ever borrowed money from me was to buy a cot.
So he didn't have to sleep on the ground and get ants in his ears.
Absolutely.
He also didn't like Mexicans. He didn't like Latin culture. He wasn't crazy about Africa or Asia either. He was very, in a way, I mean, much as he criticized American culture, he kind of was American or Eurocentric in some kind of deep philosophical way.
Yeah, and we talked about that, he and I. Yet I saw him in context, well, in Mexico, we saw both the good and the bad together. We had people with guns on us in Mexico. And boy, he was upset. So was I. We really wanted to go take those guys out. But the upshot is that they were bureaucrats turned bandits, basically, in the Navajo. The Mexican police system can get pretty dire at times. But on an individual basis, he had extraordinary compassion for any fellow human. And once it was on an individual basis and not a cultural basis, he saw it in a totally different way. And I have him on tape saying that if he could have selected a time and a place to have been born, it would have been as an 18th century Plains Indian, because he regarded that as the most heroic way to live, from horseback hunting buffalo.
Right.
And so he was not, he didn't have a phobia about Native Americans. We had many dialogues about this because I believe that there are at least strong vestiges of that earlier point of view still inherent within indigenous cultures that have been bureaucratized in some measure out of all Native American cultures, but still there's a thread that remains. And Ed didn't see that as deeply as I.
Right.
So we had a lot of discussions about that in the course of our life together.
This book, Adventures with Ed, A Portrait of Abbey, makes the reader feel like, I mean, made me feel like I knew the guy. It's so vivid. Is he still with you?
Oh, yeah. We have daily conversations. No, part of what I did when I got into this book, I wanted to really, I revisited many, many, many of our old campsites and hiked many of our old trails and ran many of our old rivers just to feel it. But Ed still comes to me frequently in dreams. And if I'm ever pondering something philosophical, I'll just sort of tune into the way Ed's head worked. And I can find either resolutions or more questions. And that's really interesting. He was about as well-read a person as I knew. Much better read than I, and I regard myself as a well-read person. But even the week, I'm trying to remember who he was writing. Santana, the week he died, he was still reading philosophy. It was amazing.
Jack Loeffler is an oral historian. He is the author of the book Adventures with Ed, A Portrait of Abby. It's wonderful talking to you, and let's keep the dialogue going.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 505-428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.